another song, Eddie. Yeah. All right, well, if you want to, you may turn to 2 Kings, and we're going to be talking about a couple stories in the book of 2 Kings chapter 5 and 5 and 6. And let's see, do we get into 7 a little bit, maybe? If I was to ask you to give me some names of some great messengers in the Bible, who would you pick? Who comes to your mind? When I say, give me some names of some great messengers in the Bible.
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist.
Gabriel.
Gabriel, okay.
Solomon.
Solomon.
Joseph.
Joseph.
Moses.
Moses. Paul, Peter, John, Isaiah. We'd have a whole list of things and keep going right on. Well, today we hope to talk about a couple of different instances in the book of 2 Kings, the chapters I mentioned, where God chose some very unlikely characters to be messengers of glad tidings to some very discouraged people. Now, I want to ask this question to you, and I want you to think about it very seriously. Have you ever considered that you very well may be a great messenger of God as well? I'm going to repeat that. Have you ever considered that you very well may be a great messenger of God as well as the ones that we mentioned just a while ago? I think you'll get my point as we get into the story. So, scene one of this first story that we're going to read about starts out in chapter 5, first three verses. It says, "Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord has given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. The Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captives a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. Then she said to her mistress, 'If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy.'" Now here's my question. Does anyone know how the captive servant girl from Israel knew Elisha, the prophet of Israel, could heal Naaman from his leprosy?
She didn't. I mean, she trusted God. Naaman knew that he'd never done that before.
Okay. Very good. That's exactly what I was thinking, Ben. Luke 4:27, Jesus said this. He said, "And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian." So, it wasn't because she had seen the prophet heal someone that had leprosy. But I'm of the same opinion that Ben is that the servant girl from Israel was well aware that the one and only God of the universe was capable of doing anything he willed, and when God worked through his appointed prophets, miracles came alive. Back in those days, leprosy was considered incurable and very contagious. Most people who had it were banned from society and lived in colonies away from the clean. And if anybody was walking near them, they had to kind of cover their face and say, "Unclean, unclean." So it was a terrible life to live, knowing that there was no cure and you were banned the rest of your life. And when the king of Israel received, As we have already read, Naaman was highly esteemed in the eyes of his king. And when a person is desperate for a cure, many people will try just about anything. And After hearing what the young girl from Israel had said about the prophet in Samaria, what does Naaman do? He goes to his king and he says, "Hey, look, listen, I've heard that I can be cured because there's a prophet in Israel." And his king highly esteemed Naaman. He says, "Well, I'll send an official letter and we'll get that taken care of." And so he sends an official letter and sends him on his way to the king of Israel with this letter requesting that he heal him. Well, now, put yourself in the shoes of the king that received that letter. Okay, the king of Israel received the letter and he became beside himself, thinking that the king of Syria was just trying to pick a fight with him. Okay, he's just wanting to make a quarrel with me to have an excuse to come down here and attack us. Surely he knows that nobody in their right mind could think that I could heal a leper. So he was quite upset. Well, the prophet Elisha, the man of God, hears of the king's upset state of mind, and he just calmly says, "Let him come to me that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel. Don't sweat. Just let him come, and I'll show him that I'm a prophet in Israel." It's interesting to me that the king never considered the prophet of God. He wasn't a very godly man, I don't think. Really, when you think about it. I mean, you would have thought that he would have thought, "Hey, I'll go straight to the prophet. We'll get this taken care of." But no, hey, it's like he just becomes outraged. Well, let's go to scene 3. That was scene 2 that we just talked about. So let's go to scene 3. That starts in verse 9 of that chapter 5. Naaman and his entourage of servants riding in chariots loaded with gifts goes to Elisha's house. Goes straight to his house. And Elisha does not come out to greet this commander of the Syrian army, but simply sends out his servant and instructs him what to do. Now, at one time I'd figured out how many miles. We're talking like well over 100 miles they had to travel to get to this place. I think in my mind it seemed like it was more like 300 miles from Damascus to Samaria. Okay? So, he had to travel a long ways, and there's no telling on the travel. I'm sure he was excited thinking about him getting healed and what it was going to be like. And so he gets there, and the prophet doesn't even come out and greet him. He just sends out one of his lowly servants, and he says, "Well, you tell me, what did the servant tell Naaman? What are you supposed to do?" Yeah, just go down to the Jordan and wash yourself 7 times. How did Naaman react to that? He was extremely angry, wasn't he? Extremely angry. Okay. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." Why was Naaman so furious? What was there about the situation that made him furious?
The Jordan was muddy.
Yeah, the Jordan was just a dirty, muddy river compared to the rivers that he was used to in Damascus. Okay? Clear and clean water. And I came all this way, and you tell me to go to the Jordan and wash.
Plus, he thought there'd be a show.
He suspected there'd be some pomp and circumstance to take place, that maybe followed by some magical incantation, I'll say it right, finally. But instead, he gets some simple instruction from a servant. Now, why do you think Elisha approached this situation the way he did? Well, first of all, Elisha didn't want this man to think in any way, shape, or form that he was the one that caused the miracle. He wanted God to get the credit, not himself. And so I think he arranged it this way. Who can tell me what stopped the angry, prideful Naaman from traveling back to Syria? Because after he got this, and he got so angry, he just turned around and started heading back. What stopped him?
His own
meek servants said to him, verse 13, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" Well, we know the rest of the story, don't we? He finally calmed himself down and he turned around and went back and thought, you know, sometimes in anger we do some pretty stupid things. And he was about to do something very stupid, and his simple little servants gave him this great message and got him thinking straight. And so he goes back, and we know after he dipped 7 times in the Jordan River, in that murky waters of the Jordan, his flesh was restored. He became clean like that of a young boy, the scripture says. Now, in all the characters of this story, whom would you say deserves the most credit? Besides God. Obviously, without God, none of this would happen. But who would you give the most credit to in this story? Okay, that would be one for sure, but I'm thinking of one even more than that. The servant of Naaman's what you meant, yeah. Or were you talking about his servants that gave him his little speech like? Which servants are you talking about? All of them?
The ones that convinced him to go back and do as he
was. Okay, all right. That's what I thought you meant. But I was thinking of another servant of Naaman. The little girl. If the little girl hadn't said what she said about her prophet in Israel, none of this would have ever took place, would it? Think of the importance of what that little girl said about the prophet that came from Israel. And we already kind of figured out why she said it. It's not because she saw somebody healed by the prophet, but she had faith in the God that caused the prophet to do the things that he did.
So she was being a messenger for God.
That's right. She was a simple, lowly messenger that said, just didn't say too much, did she? But think about it. It influenced this whole story. All right, let's go to the second story because we're going to run out of time. In 2 Kings, the 6th chapter, we read that the king of Syria was making war against Israel, but he was constantly being outfoxed when he came to getting his troops into position for engagement. The king figured that someone among them was a spy. But what was he told? Anybody remember this story? What was he told?
The prophet is listening to your conversation.
Yeah. It's not a spy. They have a prophet, and he even knows what you say in your bedroom. Okay? So to remedy this problem, the king of Syria sent a large army with chariots to surround the city of Dothan by night with the idea of taking Elisha out of the picture. Now, I think if you think about this, he's just been told, well, they've got a prophet. He knows everything you're thinking. So how does he think he's going to sneak up on them and surround the city and then not know about it? But anyway, that's his plan. So Elisha's servant wakes up early the following morning, stepping outside. He notices a mass army with chariots surrounding the city. In his amazement, he proclaims, "Master, what shall we do?" Everywhere he looked, he looked all the way around him, the whole city. It's just lined up with soldiers and chariots and horses. Very calmly, "Don't be afraid," the prophets answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "O Lord, open his eyes so he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked, and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And as the enemy came down toward him, Elisha prayed to the Lord, "Strike these people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. And Elisha told him, "This is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man you are looking for." and he led them to Samaria. The king of Israel was there when the troops' eyesight was restored, and when their eyes opened up, they look around, they realize they're in the city of Samaria. And here's the king, and the king's asking the prophet, "Shall we kill them?" No. He said, "Don't kill them." He says, "I want you to give them some food and water and send them back home." That's an awful nice thing to do, isn't it? When these people were coming to take away the prophet, that's what he did. And what was the result of him being nice to those that they basically had captured? That's right. The results of this good fortune kept those raiders away. It says the bands of the Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. So, following that, it tells us about another incident. It could be, I don't know, it's kind of strange, but it says this next incident happens. We don't know how many years in between. Could have been several years. But King Ben-Hadad of Syria gathered his army and went to Samaria and besieged it. So we're talking about the same town in Israel. And it says, during this time that they besieged it, it says there was a great famine. Now whether this was a natural famine that was occurring, or they were referring to what was going on with them besieging the city, obviously your food's going to eventually run out. You know, they basically just surrounded your city until you didn't have any more food or water to sustain you. But there was a great famine in Samaria which caused the least palatable food to go for a ridiculous amount of money. Without getting all the details, I'll just quickly mention there was talk about a donkey's head was worth an astronomical amount of money. Just to someone sell you a donkey's head to eat, or pigeon dung. So we know that the people were getting extremely desperate. Matter of fact, they got so desperate it's very gross. While the king was making his rounds on the city wall, this occurred. A woman cried out to him, saying, "Help me, Lord, O king." And he said, "If the Lord will not help you, how shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the winepress?" In other words, we're all desperate. And if God's not going to help us, I sure can't help you. That's basically what the king said. He says, "What's your trouble?" And she answered, "The woman said to me, give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow." So they're so desperate that they're eating their children. So she said, "We boiled my son and ate him, and on the next day I said to her, give your son that we may eat him. But she has hidden her son." So she's crying out for justice. When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he was passing by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body. And he said, May God do so to me, and more also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today. Why was he mad at the prophet? It could very well be because when the prophet didn't kill those men that they took in Samaria, but he fed them and let them go back home, it could be because of that. There may be some other reasons. I think one of the idea is that the prophet had said something to the effect that we just need to wait and the Lord will come to our rescue. Because the reason I say that, it says the king sent an executioner to seize the prophet. And perhaps with a change of heart, the king and an attending officer followed along shortly afterward, and the question was asked of the prophet, "Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? Surely this calamity is from the Lord." So maybe that's why he first wanted to kill him, is that I've listened to you and nothing's happening. Well, Elisha replied, Hear the word of the Lord, thus saith the Lord. Tomorrow at about this time a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. Then the captain, on whose hand the king leaned, said to the man of God, if the Lord himself should make windows in heaven, could this be? But this was replied, but you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. So basically he's saying, yes, it can be, and it will be. Now at that time there were four lepers outside the city walls. Now you remember I mentioned to you that lepers were not allowed with the people. So these four lepers, were outside the city wall. I suppose they were congregated there hoping maybe that some of their relatives would give them some kind of food. I'm sure that everything is locked up tight. So they're in a desperate situation. Lepers were forbidden by law from dwelling within the cities of Israel. Relatives within the city normally kept them supplied with food, and hence they congregated about the city gates hoping someone would feed them. But because of the extreme scarcity within the city during the siege, this was unfortunate. And, of course, they were on the verge of perishing. So the four decides this. They said, well, why don't we just go to the camp of the Syrians? Maybe they'll give us some food. And if they don't, well, if we go to the city, we're going to die there anyway. And if we go to the Syrians and they don't accept us and they kill us, so what? We're dead men anyway. So that's what they do. And so it says, the Lord had made the army of Syrians hear the sounds of chariots and horses. So here's what happens. The four lepers leave the city and they go to the camp. And when they get there, there's nobody around. It's like he sees their weapons and their gear laying all over the ground, and they go in somebody's tent and there's nobody there, and they find food and they find water and they find all kinds of treasures, and they're like, wow. I mean, it's like we struck the jackpot. Okay? So, and what had happened is the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and horses. And they had thought that maybe the king of Israel had made a pact with Egypt and the Hittites, and they heard all these noises and thought that we're being attacked. We haven't got a prayer. They're closing in on us, and so they just turn and run. So it's quite a miracle. So the leopards came to the camp. They carried off silver and gold, and they ate and drank. And then they took these clothes and stuff, and they went and they hid them. Then they came back to get some more, and they carried them off to hide them. And then they said to one another, you know what? We're not doing this right. This is not right. This day is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us. They're starting to feel guilty. Now, therefore, come, let us go and tell the king's household. So they turn around, they go back to the city, and they yell up to the people on the wall, hey, there's nobody back there. Do you think they believed them? No, the story wasn't believed. It was an unbelievable story. So, but they did exactly what they said they would do. And when the king When the king devised a plan to make sure the Syrians' retreat was not a trick, because that's what they thought, oh, this is just a trick to draw us out, but it wasn't a trick. And so, as the story goes, the guy that had made fun of Elisha's prediction, do you remember what happened to him? Yeah, he got trampled by the people leaving the city, because he was assigned to watch the gate, and the people trampled him and killed him while all the other people were getting their food and eating it. He got nothing. He died just like the prediction of Elisha was that you're going to see this food, but you're not going to get any of it. So, in all the different lessons of this story, I would like to emphasize this one thing, that sharing God's precious gift is our duty as His children. You know, to have any great gift, whether it's kindness, food or drink, or wealth or knowledge, or a myriad of other things we could list, is a requirement of the Lord's that we share. Using such gifts only for selfish purposes without regard for the needs of others is a serious, serious sin. And never is this more true than with the gift of salvation. Do we dare assume that God loved us enough that He sent Jesus to die for our sins alone, just for me? No. He saved us and He empowers us so that we can become channels through which His blessings may flow to others. And if it wasn't for Naaman's servant girl sharing her knowledge of the prophet of Israel, Naaman would have remained a leper. And here's a verse I want to finish with. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our afflictions so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any afflictions with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. So as God's witnesses, we should also remember it is the message and not the messenger that's important. God does not always choose great people to be His messengers. The Samaritan lepers were unlikely instruments for God, and so was the young slave girl who belonged to Naaman. And they only told what they knew, what they seen, and what they tasted. And the last verse I'm going to give is in James, the 4th chapter, verse 17. No matter how weak or untalented you consider yourself to be, these two stories in 2 Kings remind you and I, it is a wonderful blessing to share God's gifts with others, and to remain silent would be a sin. And the reason we know that is James 4:17 says, "So whosoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin." Well, I ran over time, but it's two great stories that give us a really good point.